Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Tommy McNeil reporting. British police say they have made an arrest in connection with Friday's rush hour bomb attack on a London subway train. Authorities say the 18-year-old man was arrested in the port area of Dover Saturday morning. That's a major ferry port for travel between Britain and France. A police statement called the arrest significant. And earlier Saturday, London Transport Authority say they had opened the Parsons Green station where the bomb on a train partially detonated. VOA's Henry Ridgewell explains that this is not new to the Brits, but still, the responses are always evolving.
Five terror attacks in Britain, four of them in London this year, all of them targeting soft targets, as police use the term, pedestrian walkways, transport hubs, places that are very difficult for the authorities to defend against. They have put some measures in place. They have put barriers along some of the key walkways and bridges across the River Thames. There is an increased armed police presence in London. But it has to be remembered that millions of people use the London subway network every day, and its bus network and its road network. And I think everybody accepts that it's impossible to defend the entire infrastructure of the city.
U.S. President Trump has responded to North Korea's most recent missile launch and remarks during a speech to military personnel and their families outside of Washington. Mr. Trump said the U.S. and its allies will never be intimidated. In the meantime, the NATO Secretary General said North Korea's missile launch is another reckless breach of U.N. resolutions and a major threat to international peace. More at voanews.com. This is VOA News. Congolese security troops killed at least 18 Burundian refugees during confrontations Friday over plans to return some of the refugees to their home. Soldiers and police opened fire as the refugees tried to free some of their compatriots in a town in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo near the border. The troops attempted to disperse the refugees by, quote, firing in the air, but were overwhelmed when the group began throwing stones. Eyewitnesses say that the soldiers continued shooting into the crowd even after some refugees were wounded. Congo-based UN communications official Florence Marshall confirmed the deaths and said that the Congolese government, the UN Refugee Agency, and UN Peacekeeping Mission in Congo have deployed teams on site to shed light on everything that happened. Protests in St. Louis, Missouri, sparked by the acquittal of a white police officer charged with murder and the death of a black man, escalated into acts of vandalism Friday night. Police say 23 people were arrested, 9 police were injured in skirmishes with protesters. Jason Stockley, a former St. Louis police officer, had been charged with the fatal shooting of Anthony Lamar Smith after a car chase in December of 2011. Prosecutors also alleged Stockley planted a gun on Smith's body. Prosecutors said the gun had only Stockley's DNA on it. Some 400,000 Rohingya have fled Myanmar's Rakhine State since August 25th, when insurgents attacked police posts, killing at least 12. Since then, aid groups have struggled with an increasingly urgent humanitarian crisis.
The obvious risk is that people don't get the assistance they need, and we could see a second wave of health problems and even death. These people are already very weak, having walked for days.
That's Vivian Tan with the UN Refugee Agency. Rohingya Muslims have been fleeing what they say is a long-term persecution in Myanmar. But the speed of their exit combined with the scale of this latest crisis is unprecedented. The United Nations reports that world hunger is rising because conflicts and problems related to climate change are multiplying. The report finds about 815 million people globally did not have enough to eat in 2016, 38 million more than the previous year. The report says that 155 million children under age 5 suffer from stunting of their bodies and often their brains, thereby dimming prospects for the rest of their lives. It notes that 52 million, or 8% of the world's children, suffer from wasting a low weight for their height. Also, it explores the problems of anemia among women and growing obesity among adults and children as well. I'm Tommy McNeil in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Well, it was an excellent hearing. It was made very clear that the U.S. government was going to be watching these elections very closely, making sure the rule of law was enforced.
The U.S. Congress Foreign Affairs Committee conducted a hearing into the future of democracy and governance in Liberia.
There will always be two camps. One camp that obviously supports Robert Mugabe and is excited about the prospect, and the other camp that generally is opposed to everything associated with Robert Mugabe.
The Zimbabwean government renames the international airport after President Robert Mugabe.
You know, they're demanding that there must be changes at the leadership of the Electoral Commission, especially at the Secretariat. The Secretariat plays a major role in the conduct or in processing the elections.
And the Kenyan main opposition party demands its major concerns be addressed before the upcoming presidential election rerun. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. The U.S. Congress Foreign Affairs Committee conducted a hearing into the future of democracy and governance in Liberia Wednesday, this recalling the West African country's emergence from the ruthless civil war orchestrated by jailed former President Charles Taylor. Ed Royce, chairman of the committee, commended Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf for leading efforts in preserving peace, rebuilding infrastructure and economy despite numerous challenges. His remarks came as the country prepares for the October general election. Dr. Alan White, who played a key role in gathering evidence against Charles Taylor, was at the hearing and told me that the lawmakers want to see a peaceful and credible Liberian general election.
Well, it was an excellent hearing. It was made very clear that the U.S. government was going to be watching these elections very closely, making sure the rule of law was enforced. Both State Department representatives, the Assistant Secretary for Africa Bureau, as well as the Acting Administrator for Africa for USAID, made it clear that they were actively engaged, as well as all of the major election observing organizations, which stated that Liberia election was in the top five of all African elections that's going to be monitored. So they want to make sure that the Nigerian Election Commission does what it's supposed to be doing. Logistically, there are enough assets deployed out into the 15 counties in the polling. And it was also made very clear that the U.S. was looking forward to working with the next administration about dealing with some of the past human rights violations, which Congressman Royce talked about. We were successful in bringing Charles Taylor to justice, but there are a lot of Liberians, some of which are actively running for president right now.
Was it clear by these congressmen and women about ensuring that the elections are free, fair, credible, and transparent?
Absolutely. This was the cornerstone of these hearings. They want to make sure, and they're going to be engaging President Sirleaf when she's in town next week. They've invited her to speak with the Congressional Black Caucus to talk about these very issues, because all of the election observers that were there, even though they claim that the Liberian people have faith and trust in the National Elections Commission, they're very concerned about the role of some of the polling stations where they could be manipulated. It's during the rainy season. So they're going to be watching that very, very closely. And they also want to make sure that the commissioner, the National Election Commission, gets what he needs and does what he's supposed to do and make sure everybody's properly registered and that that the elections are free and fair.
Charles Taylor keeps coming up because I understand that supporters of WEA and the vice presidential candidate, Jewel Howard Taylor, are going around in former Charles Taylor's stronghold, Bong County, trying to convince people to vote for WEA, saying that all kinds of things, trying to convince them that Charles Taylor could come back. Is this a concern?
Well, it's certainly a concern that anybody would be running for president in Liberia that would want to bring back a convicted war criminal that was responsible for over 200,000 deaths and over 1.2 million victims in the region between the Liberian Civil War and the Sierra Leone Civil War, which he started. Let me just say this. Congress was very concerned about this. They asked the panel members yesterday, and they asked the State Department and USAID. And the U.S. government's position was very clear that Charles Taylor is a convicted war criminal. He needs to stay where he is, and they would support no effort to ever bring Charles Taylor back to Liberia, where he could pose a threat not only to Liberia, but also to the region. There's no question that he would be a destabilizing factor. So for anybody or any person or effort to bring back a convicted war criminal that created so much devastation and destruction in human lives and the toll that it took is quite frankly absurd.
What about the issue of retributive justice? Do these congressional folks talk about the need to set up something of, you know, of a commission to prosecute those who committed horrendous crimes during the Liberian Civil War, and that, you know, will the U.S. government support such an effort?
Yes, and it was made clear from the congressional members that were there, as well as some of the panel members, that the TRC recommendations need to be implemented, and they haven't been implemented. And although there are many, the key provision that was in the TRC that was to be recommended was, that actually was recommended, was establishing a war crime tribunal. I talked to several of the panel members and Liberians. Some are expats and some still live in Liberia, claiming that overall the majority of Liberians want retributive justice.
Dr. Alan White played a key role in gathering evidence against former Liberian President Charles Taylor. He spoke with me from here in the VOA studios in Washington, D.C. Joram Gumbo, the Zimbabwean transport minister, says the country's main airport in the capital, Harare, will be named after longtime President Robert Mugabe. The transport minister says pilots and worldwide operators have been notified that beginning November 9, the Harare International Airport will be known as the Robert Mugabe International Airport. His comments came after Cabinet approved the move. Last month, the government also declared February 21 as Robert Mugabe Day, a national holiday to be observed starting next year. For reaction, I read Rejoice Ngwenya, political analyst in the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Well, look, inevitably, there will always be two camps. One camp that obviously supports Robert Mugabe and is excited about the prospect, and the other camp that generally is opposed to everything associated with Robert Mugabe. The debate has been very robust, but, you know, bear in mind, Peter, that it's not the first time that airports have been named after leaders. But as you quite rightly observe, most of these leaders are late. So I would say that there's been quite some robust debate about it. And so far, I think there is kind of a balanced opinion on both sides.
How are the opposition political parties reacting to this decision that from November 9th, the main airport will be known as Robert Mugabe's International Airport?
Precisely. You know, opposition is quite aware that we have Oliver Tambo, we have Jomo Kenyatta, there is even JFK Kennedy. So it's nothing new, really, to name an airport after a leader. But what type of a leader is it? The opposition is asking, can you have an airport named after Idi Amin, after Adolf Hitler, you know, after Jean Bokassa? You know, this is it is the question of the integrity of the individual. That symbolism of dictatorship and oppression is the one that mainly the opposition parties are saying, look, there are more important things to do other than just focusing on the international airport. Besides, it's a very expensive exercise to start changing the names and the geographical coordinates. So really, it's really up to the, it's about the integrity of the person rather than the motive of the change of name.
So what prompted this action from the government to rename the airport? Did they say why?
No, they would never say why. Look, I mean, what's happening, there's been this whole series of transformations, you know, the names of universities, you know, the the holidays being named after Mugabe, and of course the latest being the international airport. There is a strong feeling among citizens that this is an extension of Mugabe's 2018 electioneering, so that his name is deified. This is almost like deity. It's part of the extension of the political brand that should be very visible during the 2018 watershed election. So it's about electoral campaigning. The motive is basically being condemned as an extension of Mugabe's electoral, campaign message.
Some Zimbabweans I spoke with said the country faces economic challenges. The living conditions of public sector workers appear not to be too good, and that the government should rather focus on improving the lives of people in Zimbabwe and addressing the economic challenges the country faces. Do you share in that assessment?
Absolutely, I do, really, but that would be first in 37 years. I think we all know that Mugabe and his government have never really been interested in the welfare of the citizens of the country. There is so much waste, there is so much plundering. Right now, what is trending is this $10 million, entourage to New York. People have always complained about the plunder and the waste, but the message will never, ever get to ZANU-PF. They have no interest in that. I'm saying it's very expensive to change an airport, the name of an airport, especially given the current, a negative economic environment. But does Mugabe care? He doesn't care. It's all about the ZANU-PF brand before the 2018 election.
Rejoice Ngwenya is a Zimbabwean political analyst. He spoke with me from Harare. 15 supporters from the Tanzanian main opposition party Chadema have been released from prison following an arrest. The police say the opposition supporters were arrested for illegally assembling to carry out a political activity without a permit. The opposition disagrees, saying this is yet another attempt by the government to stifle any dissent and suppress the opposition using state institutions, including the police. Chadema says the supporters went to a hospital to donate blood as a sign of solidarity to Tundu Lissu, a parliamentarian and a prominent member of the party who survived a recent assassination attempt. John Malia, head of the opposition party's legal affairs, told me it appears the government is intent on clamping down on opponents.
15 members of Chadema in Dar es Salaam were arrested at the Temeke District Hospital. Now, these people went and volunteered to donate their blood as a sign of solidarity at this moment when our leader and member of parliament, Tundu Lissu, is undergoing treatment. It is a sign of solidarity and a sign that blood donation should be a normal exercise to Tanzanians, and as a sign of love to our beloved MP who is in the hospital. Now, they were arrested in a manner that is very illegal, because volunteering donation of blood is no way a crime in this country. So they were arrested, but fortunately our lawyers went to the police station and later they were bailed out. So they are now free, but they spent a night in a police custody.
Well, did the police say why they were arrested? Because I understand they were wearing Chadema clothes, which the police see as an infringement on an order banning political activities in Tanzania.
The police did not give any specific provision of the law that was infringed. The only thing that they said is that the assembly was illegal and that they had to seek police permit before I donate blood, which is actually not true. The provision of the law are very clear on how you go into a facility such as an hospital. You don't require a permit from anybody. You don't ask for permission from the police to go to a hospital for treatment, similar to the donation of blood. So it's a continuation, in my view, of brutality of the police and infringing constitutional rights of Tanzanians, particularly political parties, which has been conducted by the Magufuli regime.
The police blamed Chadema for not reporting that Tundu Lissu was being followed before he was nearly assassinated. What is your reaction to that? Because they blame Chadema for not alerting the police that his life was in danger.
Tundu Lissu reported his incident directly, pointing out and giving the attention of his reports to the IGP, Commander Siro. and to the head of intelligence and security. And he said in a press conference that I'm being followed by a car with this registration number. With that, it was followed by a letter drawn by Bavicha chairman complaining that Tundu's life is in danger, and that letter was addressed to the IGP. That is number one. Number two, and when an MP, a member of parliament, complains in a press conference, normally whenever he says anything about Magufuli or anything about the government, the police know and react. But this report, it was not reacted upon. So the police neglected the danger that Tundu Lissu was facing.
How is he doing now? Because I understand he is at a hospital in Nairobi where he is receiving medical treatment. I also understand there are plans by Chadema to fly him to the U.S. For further medical treatment. How is he doing at the moment?
Fairly well. The doctors are saying his life is not in danger as it was a few previous days. He's a bit improving, but Tundu Lissu was injured very grievously. He has been in a condition that is very bad. He was shot, and now we get a report from the doctors in Nairobi that 8 bullets were landed in his body, not 5 as we presumed or were informed earlier. So he's a bit critical, but truly he needs some more medical treatment and some more attention in order for him to stabilize and normalize, and so that he can come back and perform his duty.
Talking about prayers, the youth of Chadema plan to have a prayer session on Sunday for Tundu Lissu to pray for good health. Could you foresee any problem happening since the police have banned any political activity?
I wish the police would understand that freedom of expressing your faith is not a political activity at all. It's totally a faith thing. It has nothing to do with politics. So I presume that the police will be reasonable and understand that this is purely something to do with the religion and not with politics.
John Malia is the head of legal affairs for the Tanzanian main opposition party, Chadema. He spoke with me from Arusha. The Kenyan main opposition, the National Super Alliance, or NASA, has demanded that all of its major concerns be addressed before the party will participate in the presidential election rerun. In a letter to the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, or IEBC, the opposition leaders also made specific accusations against electoral officials they want punished. Isaac Ongiri is a senior political reporter for the Daily Nation, a major Kenyan independent newspaper. My colleague Douglas Mpuga reached him in the capital, Nairobi, by phone to find out the seriousness of the opposition demands.
From the look of those demands, I think they are quite serious, because, you know, they are demanding that there must be changes at the leadership of the Electoral Commission, especially at the Secretariat. The Secretariat plays a major role in the conduct or in processing the elections. And given that the Supreme Court appeared to have made some accusations against the commission, it is expected that somebody should take responsibility. And I think they are targeting the Secretariat and other directorates within the Electoral Commission.
You rightly point out that among their demands are reforms at the Independent Electoral and Boundaries Commission, including personnel changes. What are the chances that that can happen?
At the moment, it would appear that the commission is very adamant. They are non-receptive to the demands by the opposition. And the government side, the Jubilee side, appears to be supporting the Electoral Commission largely. So it remains to be seen whether their demands will be met.
Also, NASA accuses President Uhuru Kenyatta's party of intimidating the independence of the judiciary, especially through the filing of a petition before the Judicial Service Commission seeking the removal of the Kenya's top judge. How does that play into the possibility of having these demands not met?
You know, from what we've seen is that the Jubilee side has not totally agreed with the verdict of the court, while the NASA side, being the beneficiary of that decision, they are in full agreement. So when yesterday we saw the Nyeri Member of Parliament, Ngunjiri Wambugu, coming up with a petition against the Chief Justice, it means then that the government side is serious in trying to screw up the Supreme Court and the judiciary. So it is a tug of war.
It's not known who will actually finally win the war.
Political gimmicks aside, given the time constraint, because the election is slated for October 17th, what's the possibility that some of these NASA demands would be met?
Knowing how the election process preparation is actually not something very easy, and given the time constraints, it is very difficult for the Electoral Commission to make changes within the commission because the recruitment process will take quite some time. But it was expected that those who were suspected to have been indicted by the Supreme Court verdict would have voluntarily stepped aside to allow the others who were not grievously mentioned to proceed with those responsibilities. You know, there is a demand that there should be a cleanup of the entire system, what we call the KIMS, the technology that was used to conduct that election should be cleaned, the servers, which I think is not something that can happen within a day. So it's a very difficult moment in the country at the moment.
What would happen if these demands were not met? Is there a chance that NASA could boycott the election?
They have already made their threats. They are insisting that if these demands are not met, then they will boycott the election. What that means is simply that there will be a lot of chaos on the election day should NASA decide not to participate in those elections. But from the government side, they are saying that if NASA boycotts the election or refuses to participate in those elections, then the Electoral Commission should declare President Uhuru Kenyatta the sole candidate and therefore be awarded the victory certificate so that the government can proceed to swear him in so that he can take over the president. So we are facing an uncertain situation in the country at the moment due to the antagonistic sides taken by the opposition and the government.
Isaac Ongiri is a senior political reporter for the Daily Nation, a major Kenyan independent newspaper. He spoke with my colleague Douglas Mpuga from Nairobi. A survey finds the United States is the world's top small arms trader in a multi-billion dollar industry, followed by Italy, Brazil, Germany, and South Korea. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more on the Small Arms Survey's Trade Update 2017, Out of the Shadows.
The survey says at least $6 billion in authorized global arms trading took place in 2014, $200 million more than the year before. The survey shows the U.S. bought fewer small arms in 2013 when purchases declined from $2.5 billion to $2.2 billion. Nevertheless, it says the U.S. remains the world's largest importer of small arms, followed by Canada, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, and Germany. The U.S. is also the top seller of small arms with exports of $1.1 billion in 2014. The report also highlights the role of the least transparent small arms sellers. Iran, Israel, North Korea, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates got the lowest scores on the survey's transparency index of exporters. Israel, for the first time, has scored 0 points, while North Korea has consistently failed the transparency test. The report's authors warn the concealed nature of the small arms trade increases the chances small weapons will fall into the wrong hands and help fuel conflict and instability. Small Arms Survey senior researcher Paul Holtum tells VOA it is hard to know who is receiving small arms and ammunition from places like North Korea.
One assumes that some of the major recipients from North Korea in 1980s, 1990s have continued to be recipients, and so there's been work carried out by the UN panel of experts monitoring the sanctions on North Korea that's highlighted a number of countries in sub-Saharan Africa that have received assistance in various forms. Current investigations, I understand, are going on with regard to Namibia, with regard to small arms production that's been there, with Uganda, with Eritrea, and with the Democratic Republic of Congo.
Regarding regional trends, the survey finds between 2001 and 2014, the Americas accounted for 40% of documented global small arms imports, followed by Europe, Asia, and the Pacific and Africa. While the Africa region only imported 4% of small arms, the survey notes the value of trade there nearly tripled from $82 million to $237 million during that 13-year period. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Fire, baby. Fire, 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 baby. Fire, baby. Fire, 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 baby. Fire, baby. Fire, 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 baby. 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 sina yotanjema ifajiri chana uzima wana kesha kulitabiri pendo kuchina edhi tena wengine wakubwa mili watu wazima tala kunani burugu mechi mkwa kwani mtoto dari wakandana samba chumbani endo mesi uwanjani sini pie simba yanga nyuma kama tsunami jinsi kuna tetema sura zarina sana shepu sepetu em I say yo fire baby yo
fire 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 baby
fire oh oh
fire 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 baby
cheka sura kitoto
fire 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 fire
akini gusa kabisa ndo moto
fire 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 fire
let me tell you something about this bubble
Baby, I love you, no part two.
I'm in love with you.
And baby, I love you and I always do.
My heart's not for you.
I'll be a Rambo and Commando too.
Everything I do, everything I do, not for you.
Song you they sweets me like biscuits. Said no injury, Deca. I'll give you my number later. Magavella, na yeta, na na na. She calling me techie. They want to see money, daddy. The girl she they make me the party. Like say I they play Super Mario. Yeah. Follow me down to Putago. Me and you play Nintendo. Anyhow you want it, I like it. See anyhow you want it, I like it. I love it.
Diana, give me life, Diana.
I love you.
And that was music from the continent. We hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Justin Thwaite, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the hyena chasing two antelopes at the same time will go to bed hungry. I'm your host, Peter Clotter in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
University of Indonesia student Catherine, who goes by one name, was selected as one of the five winners of the 4th Annual Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights Youth Debate. The commission, known as AICHR, is supported by the U.S. Agency for International Development and the U.S. Department of State. The Youth Debate is a commemorative event for the 40th anniversary of U.S.-ASEAN relations. From September 4th to September 6th, 40 university students from each of the 10 ASEAN member states competed in Bangkok, Thailand, and exchanged views on human rights issues facing the region, such as women's rights, economic growth, the rights of ASEAN citizens to work in all member states, protection of the environment, and the establishment of an ASEAN human rights court. Human rights is a crucial issue that needs to be discussed more often, especially by youth, said Catherine. The AICHR Youth Debate is an opportunity for me to learn and discuss about various thoughts and perspectives on human rights issues in ASEAN with youth from all across the region. This is the fourth time AICHR has gathered youth together to debate the most pressing human rights issues of the day, said H.E. Dr. Siri Nanthasut, representative of Thailand to AICHR. This year's competition was particularly festive, as we are celebrating the 50th anniversary of ASEAN. The United States partners with ASEAN to support economic integration, expand maritime cooperation, cultivate emerging leaders, promote opportunity for women, and address transnational challenges. Human rights is an integral aspect of the ASEAN community. Through AICHR, ASEAN is promoting progressive social development and justice and the full realization of human dignity and the attainment of a higher quality of life for ASEAN people, as outlined in the ASEAN Human Rights Declaration and the Phnom Penh Statement on the Adoption of ASEAN Human Rights Declaration. Ambassador Daniel Shields, chargé d'affaires, U.S. mission to ASEAN, who spoke at the Youth Debate Award ceremony, said, "These students are part of a broader community of young leaders who inspire all ASEAN citizens to think more critically about human rights issues across the region. The United States is proud to support this activity, and we are confident that this will contribute to building a stronger ASEAN."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.